Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of They Might Be Mariners, your Mariners prospects-focused podcast. I'm your host, John Troopin, along with co-host Joe Doyle. Joe, how are you this morning?
I'm doing okay. How you doing, John?
We're doing as well as we can in these times, of course. So we're very excited. Today we've got an expert on the phone taking some time to talk with us about their view on the Mariners system, on the MLB draft, and sharing their expertise. We have Jonathan Mayo from MLBpipeline.com, been covering the MLB draft and prospects there for over two decades, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, Jonathan. Man, I'm old.
Is that, yeah, how are you doing? This has to be a really strange time for you, even with your extensive experience. There's probably not been too much like this.
It should be noted I started covering the draft when I was six. no, that's not true. It is yes, it is definitely a strange time, in two ways. Obviously, we're all used to there being baseball on the non-draft side. You know, by now there'd be prospects out playing, and we would be, you know, sort of getting a sense of how they started. We'd be doing a bunch of stories about guys off to hot starts, all, you know, the normal rhythm of the season. On the other side of things, especially in terms of the draft, because there is still going to be a draft, I have days where I forget. Like, it's just a normal day. Like, we're working on a draft list. We're preparing for the draft. We'll start putting out mocks. I'm busy. You know, so much of what we do at MLB Pipeline is not beholden to the rhythms of a normal season. So it's good. It's kind of easy to get lost in that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that is... It's good to hear that you're at least able to have those moments, where it's sort of, it feels a little, you got that bit of normalcy, because there's really nothing normal feeling about all of this. I mean, how does this sort of change your, your day to day? Obviously, there's not really much baseball happening, so you can't be getting live looks. But you know, what is your day to day, working in terms of trying to get information, trying to get prepped for the draft, trying to get info on prospects? How does that manifest for you?
Right. So I think, like with everyone, it starts with me trying to decide if today is the day I'm just not going to get out of bed. In all reality, this time of year, even during a regular season, we're not running around going and seeing players. Jim Callis and I, for the draft, and Ed and Mike Rosenbaum, when we talk about minor league prospects, we're very much more in the camp of reporters and collectors of information and not in that camp of people who do this kind of thing, who go out and evaluate players. Now, when we see a guy in the fall league or spring training or PDP league for high schoolers in the draft, whatever it is, we know what we see, but it's not like some other folks who do this sort of thing and base it on their own eyeballing of players. So much of what I'm doing right now for the draft was the same as what we were doing. Now, we're not getting updated reports because no one's going out and seeing the players now. But we're talking to scouts about, area scouts and cross-checkers and scouting directors about, how they're stacking up the board. And that's how we ended up putting together the draft, the 100 top 150 list that just came out that'll be expanded to 200. It's kind of the same process that we've always gone through in a lot of ways.
So things are obviously a little bit different this year in that there's, like you said, there's not a lot of evaluation that's going on right now. But if you look at the last 10 to 20 years, how has your job changed? How has it become easier? Because we're in a day and age when not only is societal hype and exposure increasing exponentially, but I think within the industry, the value of prospects has grown to levels we haven't seen before. How has that kind of changed, or how have you tinkered the way that you work with more eyes on what you're doing?
Yeah, it's funny because I started at MLB.com in April of 1999. My go-to joke is that I created the internet with Al Gore. And so when I first got there, I knew what the draft was, but no one was paying attention to it. It was a conference call that they had just the year before, I think, for the first time, put the conference call online. And that did really, really well. And then, so I started doing some draft stories. There was really back then, nobody other than maybe Baseball America was really providing coverage. And that's, it's grown since then, but exponentially, explosion of the internet, more and more people going out and doing this, I think it's all been good. I think the biggest changes really are just the proliferation of people who are covering the draft and minor league prospects. And I think it's been great for the game. There's so much more video out there. So even casual fans can go and look at, a video of a guy so that when they get to the big leagues for the first time, he's not a complete unknown. Now, maybe they've only read about him, but chances are they've probably seen him. The Futures game, spring training, the Arizona Fall League has gotten so much more coverage. That's largely, to pat ourselves on the back, has been because of us. Every time I talk about the Fall League, I'm like, people really should go because it's such a great experience. But so there is much, these names of guys who were previously unknown are now much more known. And in terms of the draft, went on TV for the first time in 2007. We had 2 years on ESPN, and then we moved over to MLB Network when MLB Network started up. And it's still not the NFL draft or the NBA draft, obviously, because the amateur side of this sport is not as popular. I don't think that it's carried over to people watching a ton more college baseball, although they can, because now there are all these conference networks that cover, that carry a lot of those games. The high school guys are tougher, they're the All-American games and things like that. But by and large, at least the names, the top names, are much more known, even to the casual fan who may be curious, even if it's just to know who their favorite team is going to take in the first round.
On a total sidebar, what are your thoughts on, let's call them internet scouts. you know, folks that come out of the woodwork and have, you know, these really loud opinions on players that maybe they haven't seen, but they've just seen comps. Like, that's something that's obviously brand new to the industry, probably in the last 5 years. Is that something that maybe gets in the way of your job sometimes in the comments or in the questions? Just people that maybe assume they know what they're talking about, but haven't had their eyes on the product?
It, I wouldn't say it gets in the way. I have to be careful here, right? I can't bite the hand that feeds
me. You are talking to two right, semi-internet scouts. So,
so I'm you know, tap dancing around the eggshells here just a little bit. Listen, all of it, when taken in totality, is great. I think social media, I think particularly Twitter, as incredible a tool as it is, like with lots of things, you know, baseball related and not baseball related, it can be a terrible, terrible place. I'm all for people voicing their opinions. I like interacting with fans. I feel like the immediacy of social media, particularly Twitter, combined with people who feel that they definitively know something, is a bad combination. And when you add in the fact, especially with the draft or evaluating players in general, it is such an inexact science that anyone
right.
who feels that they know certainly anything, it just doesn't understand how any of it works. And it can be frustrating at times because, yes, there are people who feel just because they attended a minor league baseball game that they're suddenly an expert. And that's why I go out of my way, guys, to always tell people that I am not an evaluator. I didn't work under the wing of somebody in a longtime scout or a scouting director. Yes, I've seen enough baseball where I can recognize things, and that obviously impacts where we rank a guy. You know, I spent 9 days covering, or whatever it was, covering the PDP league. Some of those high school guys stand out to me because I saw a lot of them. That's human nature. But I always tell people, anytime I do any interviews about this kind of stuff, that I rely on the people whose job it is to evaluate these guys. I'm not signing a check, seven figures, for some high school player. So, you know, I'm not, and those who do know how uncertain and inexact all of this is. So I think it's more the certainty of opinion that gets under my skin sometimes. And then the fact that, you know, people just have a general lack of respect for what you do. And I'm not just talking about myself. I think in general, the dialogue, quote unquote, that takes place on social media now, speaks volumes about where we are as a society. But that's a whole different conversation, maybe for a different podcast. But I think it figures into how some of those sort of armchair scouts go about interacting with people online.
You know, as a kind of as a segue, I was talking to a big league scout a couple of days ago, and he left me with a pretty a quote that kind of struck me. He said, if you're a big league scout and you've made it this far, you are understanding that you will never be right. You will never, ever be right. Your job is to make an educated analysis on a player as to what that player could be. But I guarantee you, what you think they will be, you will be wrong every single time. I thought, oh, that's, you know, that's a different way of looking at things. So,
I mean,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I mean, you know, you talk to any scouting director, you know, or any even longtime area scout, and they love telling the stories about especially the area scouts, you know, the 35th rounder they got who made it, you know, and the things, the guys that they hit on who became stars. But they love telling the stories on the guys that they just missed in both directions. You know, it's that's part of the deal. You need to have a short memory. And most of those guys do have a short memory because you can't worry about the guys you missed. Now, if you keep missing first round picks, you're going to be out of a job. But, you know, there's a results-based industry with the understanding that it, you know, with the understanding that you're going to miss a lot of the time. And those are great stories.
Well, on that note, let's jump into the Mariners farm system and a bunch of guys, 80 guys that won't miss. Let's jump into that. When you take a look at Seattle and the farm system that they've kind of, you know, reclamated here in the last couple of years, what sticks out? What are your personal thoughts on the organization's farm?
Well, you know, I mean, a lot of it was just that the dedication to rebuilding it rather than trading from it. You know, I think when Jerry DePoto and company sort of flipped that switch, they did it with intention and seriousness, and they were able to do it across pretty much every avenue of acquiring talent that you can. You know, having a bad team allowed for higher draft picks, but even when they didn't draft super high, I think they've drafted smartly, especially up top. They, you know, more active in the international market, and they made some, you know, some really good trades. And I think the combination of that is why, you know, if you look at, you know, even like their top 10, it's one deeper than it, so much deeper than it used to be. And overall, when compared to other teams, is, you know, got an up arrow next to it. And it's why we now look at the Mariners as having one of the better overall farm systems. So I think it's that they committed to rebuilding the system and then used every tool in their toolkit to do that.
How about specifically, like you were mentioning at the top, any general thoughts on Kelnick, Julio, and Gilbert? Because that's three guys. And you know what? Let's throw Evan White in there. That's four guys that, by my estimation, in tracking this, all four of those guys went up, you know, 40, 50, 60 spots in the rankings over the 2019 season.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, I could take each one individually, I guess. I mean, I love Kelnick coming out of the draft. I don't know what they're doing in Wisconsin, but they just teach guys to hit. You got Kelnick, you got Gavin Lux. I mean, it's kind of weird. But he can really, really hit. He's a freaking physical specimen. And he's got a little chip on his shoulder, like in a really good way. He wants to be really, really good, and he wants to be better than everyone else. And I think that's going to enable him to maximize what are some really good overall tools. I mean, we're talking 60 hit and 60 run with above average power. I think he's going to be a, you know, like a 2020 kind of guy. Julio Rodriguez is just the complete package, and you know, not starting with his personality, which is, you know, 1,000 watts. I mean, he's got superstar written all over him because of that. And then you add his tools, how dedicated he is to the craft, to learning English, so he can communicate with his teammates. I think he's the kind of guy who's going to make everyone around him better because he's such a high energy, and not in a, okay, you know, young dude, tone it down. Like, he already has an innate ability to understand, you know, the room, you know, so when he's super young, he'll, you know, keep his head down kind of thing and do his thing while also showing his character and personality. He just loves to play. Even, you know, seeing him in the fall league after a long season, you know, even though he missed time with the hairline fracture, he was playing every game as if it was game 7 of the World Series with a smile on his face. I mean, he just loves to play the game, and he's really, really freaking good at it. You know, Gilbert, I think, as frontline starter, I'm going to try to be a little brief here. And Evan White is, you know, it's not often when you have a first baseman who gets mentions as the best defensive player in all of baseball, not just at his position, period. And he can really, really hit. I think the power is going to keep coming. So it's pretty impressive, and we didn't even get to George Kirby and Marte, so that just shows you how deep the system is.
I got one more question on Kelnick. It seems like the industry as a whole has it as Adele, Robert, and Kelnick. One of Kelnick or Carlson Waters, basically those five. What do you think separates Robert and Adele from, you know, Kelenic? Is Kelenic a tier below those two? What are your thoughts?
I think, you know, we may look back and they may be very comparable in terms of what their performance is. I think when you're looking at just the raw tools, I think Adele and Robert are just a shade ahead, whether it's, you know, Adele's power, Robert's speed, whatever it is. And I'm not even looking at their grades. So I, you know, if I have that slightly wrong, I just think the total package of raw tools for those guys are a tiny bit better. Adele is just a monster of a man too. And, you know, Robert, I think is a little bit bigger. Maybe that's the one thing that puts Kelenic a quarter step behind. You know, he's not the biggest, you know, from a size wise, I mean, physicality wise, he's ridiculous. Maybe, you know, so that puts him maybe a quarter step behind. I'm sure if Jared were listening to this, he would respectfully disagree. that's what makes players like him want to be, you know, want to be all-star caliber players. You know, like I said, it's, you know, you're splitting hairs a little bit just in terms of where these guys rank. But I think, you know, if I had to put my finger on one thing, it's the raw tools for Adele and Robert are a little tiny bit, ahead.
I think that's fair. Going back to something that you had mentioned a couple minutes ago, you said the Mariners farm system as a whole is deeper, as a whole than it has been over the past several years. Is there a guy maybe outside of the top 8 or 10, you know, maybe Noel V. Marte is the end point, I guess. Is there a guy after Marte that you're fond of that maybe the industry isn't as loud on right now?
Well, it's funny because, you know, the back end of the list and all these get, you know, it thins out. There's some like really interesting relievers that I like, but they're not the guys that you're talking about. Like Sam Delaplane is going to be a really good big league reliever. And anyone who saw that slider in the Arizona Fall League knows he's going to be a big league reliever, but that's not the guy I want to pick. Let me think. Can I pick two?
Absolutely.
Oh, be my guest.
We would love right. that.
So the first,
and guy for what it's worth.
Yes.
Really, for what it's worth, you're talking to the biggest Joey Gerber fan club in, you know, on earth. So I respect relievers.
Okay, fair enough. So up top, I'll start with Jake Fraley, because I think that's going to be one of those that people look back and realize that they got a really good deal. And I like Mike Zunino. I think he's going to be a fine big league catcher for a long time. Good dude. But Fraley is one of these guys that I think they kind of stole because he'd been hurt. And he's a little bit old, quote unquote, older. Maybe he'll turn 25 in about a month. But man, he's got some tools and he was really figuring it out. If you told me that he's going to end up being like an everyday center fielder in the big leagues for 10 years or for a long time, I could believe it. Like he's really exciting to me because his development got stunted because of the injuries. And I think the Mariners did a really nice job of identifying him and getting him. Probably they bought low on him because of the injuries. If I'm going to go down a little bit lower, I'm going to pick a guy who is from my area in the draft. Jim Callis and I kind of split the country in half. And that's Austin Shenton, who, you know, they got from Florida International. And another guy who, like, he had a huge Cape Cod League. Then he struggled as a junior. He had some family stuff at, you know, at home that I'm sure was distracting him. Then he got hot at the end. And they got him in, you know, the Mariners got him in the fifth round. I think this guy's really going to hit. You know, you mentioned Kyle Seager. You know, I could see him being that kind of slightly under the radar guy. Now, Seager was maybe a little bit more known because it was, you know, maybe because it was North Carolina and not Florida International. And Shenton had, you know, transferred from a junior college. I think he's really going to hit, and I think he's going to be fine at third. He may move around, play some outfield corners. He'll play wherever. I think his bat is going to get him into the lineup, and he almost reminds me of kind of a typical St. Louis Cardinals college bat taken in the mid late rounds.
I love that.
About and end up being much better big leaguers than anyone expected. So I would, you know, once we start playing baseball again and all that stuff, he's a guy that I'm keeping my eye on because I have a feeling that he is going to hit. And Scout told me a long time ago when I first started doing this, and it's just true, like there are always exceptions, but like if guys hit, they find their ways into a big league lineup. And I think he's going to be one of those guys, even if he never, you know, wins a gold glove at third.
Does he have the type of tools that could crack him into the top 100 prospects list at any point? He kind of has that Ryan Mountcastle profile.
Interesting. Yeah, you know what? I think he needs to have a little track record. You know, if this were a normal, you know, year and he went out and had a big first full season, now, you know, I think they would have sent him straight to the California League, you know, to start. I think if he had been a guy who like really, really hit, and California League is tough to truly evaluate because it's such a good hitters league, but then went to say he got to Double A in his first full season, hit there, I could see him maybe sneaking on. You know, Mountcastle hit pretty much everywhere, so Chenton would have to do that. Mountcastle was younger, coming out of high school, hit right away. So maybe it might take Chenton a little bit longer, but he just strikes me as the kind of guy that even if he wasn't a top 100 guy, you'd look back on and be like, huh, maybe he should have been just because of the offensive profile and upside.
Yeah. Well, that's fair. So we've talked about a lot of prospects, and the Mariners have a rich history of prospects, if you will, and the fan base out here is starved for a winner. It's, you know, everyone knows it's been a long time since this team has seen the playoffs, and they've gone through a lot of prospects that haven't worked out. They've gone through the Nick Franklins. They've gone through the Ackleys, the Monteros, the Smokes, Alex Jackson, DJ Peterson. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So just as a talent evaluator and someone that is well-connected in the industry, tell the Seattle fans why this crop of players is any different than what they've had in the past. Or I guess a better way of phrasing this is, why should they believe in this pool of talent?
What choice do you have? I mean, I think,
you know, that's fair. That's a good point.
It's, you know, it's, I'm not saying that you drink the Kool-Aid, you know, and anybody in what I do, or even on the scouting or player development side, you know, having good prospects is great, but until they get to the big leagues and win games, or you sort of very mindfully use them as trade pieces for that last bit, you know, it doesn't matter. I remember talking to the Kansas City Royals back in like 2011 or whatever, when they had, everyone thought they had the best farm system in baseball. And even then they said, well, it's nice that people think that, but it doesn't matter until we win. And then they did. So, you know, some of it can't be done until it's retrospective, but I think it goes back to what we were talking about, even with, you know, with amateur scouts, is that how inexact the science it is. And it's, comes and goes. Sometimes you're right and sometimes you're wrong. And yes, they missed on some of those players. And, you know, some of them you had not, you know, you look back, everyone thought Dustin Ackley was the best college bat in that draft class. Everyone thought Danny Holson was the best arm. You know, so why Dustin Ackley didn't become a superstar is one of those head scratchers. Danny Holson, you can't predict injuries. You know, Alex Jackson was the best high school bat. You know, they thought they were being smart by moving him to the outfield so the bat would carry him. Like, so much is unknown about what's going to happen once a guy starts going through the grind and having to figure it out that you just don't know. And meanwhile, like, yeah, Justin Smoke, by the way, turned into like a good big leaguer. It just took longer, you know. So I'm not like a Mariners front office apologist in any way, shape, or form. I just think that what happens, and I think that they've, you know, they've tweaked who it is that, you know, that making decisions, and they work more as a collaborative now. I think they've gotten better in combining the scouting with the data analysis, and I think all of that has pointed to them making better choices in who they're bringing into their system. It sounds simple, it's not, you know, but it right now they I think they're making some very good choices.
I think that's a good way of approaching things. All you can kind of do is, there is light at the end of the tunnel, and believe or not, there's not really any other, it's black or white. You guys over at MLB.com have been, you've started doing a really fun series about the most hyped organizational prospect at certain positions. You just rolled out shortstop the other day, and whether or not those shortstop prospects could become the most valuable player at their position in their organization's history. So I wanted to pose that question to you and kind of talk about some of the Mariners prospects that might have a chance to become, you know, the top of the mountain at their position. Now, that's going to be pretty damn tough with Kelenic unseating Ken Griffey Jr. It's just, I mean, I'd put everything I own up against that argument.
I'm sorry, who? Ken who?
I don't know if he's
senior or junior.
I remember his dad. Did the kid amount to anything?
I think he was around for a couple years. Kind of a flash in the pan. And then Julio's probably not going to become Ichiro, and they're polar opposite profiles anyways. But the one guy I did want to point out would be Evan White at first base. Seattle doesn't have a rich history of first baseman. Alvin Davis is kind of the cream of the crop with 22 WAR over a number of years. From what you've seen, do you think Evan White is the type of player that could maybe surpass that someday?
Well, it's funny. We just spent all this time talking about Mariners prospects who missed, so now you give me a little gun shy. But I think that, yeah, I think he does have the potential to be a better career than Alvin Davis. And it's funny because when we did the first baseman, typically what we've done, we do those stories, and then on our podcast, we kind of talk about some of those guys who have the chance to supplant them. And Alvin Davis is one of those guys that if you're not from the area, you're not a Mariners, and like, he was sneaky good. You know, you mentioned the WAR.
Absolutely.
He was a really solid player. So if Evan White at the end of his career looks, and you're looking back, and he didn't quite become Alvin Davis, that doesn't mean that he was a failure as a prospect. You know what I mean? Like, it's people forget, like, yes, we talk about Evan White and we ranked him highly and things like that. And there is the hope that he can be a better all around player than Alvin Davis when all is said and done, but he could come close and, you know, you decide he ends up with 20 WAR or whatever sort of benchmark you want to use. And you're like, well, he didn't quite get there. That doesn't mean that he didn't live up to his potential. I think it means that he just was really good and then that's fine. You know, it's I always feel bad when we were doing that first base. I feel bad for John Olerud, who I know had, you know, a lot of years with Toronto, but he was pretty good as a Mariner too, just not there for that long.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, very good.
Second best first baseman in Mariners history.
Well, and I think of Olerud when I think of Evan White. Because I think there are some similarities in the offensive profile. I think White's a little more athletic, or a lot more athletic, because, you know, Evan White could go play the outfield, by the way. Like, he could play center, and he'd be fine. You would never do that because he's so good at first, but he could.
Would he be as good as Griffey? Do we think
you keep bringing up this Griffey guy. yes. Yeah, that's right. Evan White is better than Jared Kelenic and Julio Rodriguez combined. In all seriousness, yeah, I mean, I think there is a good chance that Evan White could be better than Alvin Davis when all is said and done. That's to shorten up what ended up being a very long-winded answer.
You know, you said something in there that I think is really important to reiterate. Just because a player hits a top 100 list does not mean that they are destined to become a superstar. Some of these players are just destined to be good big league regulars and accumulate, you know, 8 WAR over the course of, you know, 8 to 10 seasons, and that's okay. And I think that's lost in the narrative a lot of times. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, I mean, baseball's hard. Baseball's hard. Like,
it is.
Get how difficult it is to get to the big leagues and be good for any length of time. So just because a guy was ranked high, and let's say he goes and has a 6-year career, you know, look at Justin Smoke. Like, I think we're going to look back and be like, you know what? The Mariners weren't wrong. Like, it just took him a while. He's, you know, he had some good years. It's just, was he as good as everyone thought he might be? No, but man, it's a hard game.
It is, and I think we're a year or two away from Jesus Montero having the exact same conversation around him. Maybe not. Definitely not. Right. But maybe not.
I'm sorry.
Hey, I want to.
I just keep thinking of ice cream sandwiches when you bring up
that. Yeah, look out. Look out. Dodge left. I want to talk a little bit about player development as a whole from the industry side. How have you seen things change over the last 5 to 10 years in terms of just how predictive has talent become? It's obviously still an exact science, and people are going to miss more times than they're going to hit. But have you seen a shift in scouting and just how scouts go about things and their success rates?
Well, I mean, without having done, you know, any real data dive in terms of percentage of guys who make it to the big leagues or whatever, one of the things, as we've talked about, is what do you define success from a player development standpoint? Is it getting a guy to the big leagues? Is it getting him there and he's ready to contribute? Nowadays, most player development staffs, that's their, you know, I think how they look at it. They want a guy when he gets called up to be ready so he can stay. Now, it doesn't mean he's going to stay, and that doesn't always happen. I always like pointing to Mike Trout, who in his first time up in the big leagues was not good. People like to forget that. It didn't take anything away from his stock as a prospect or a future star, and then he figured it out, obviously. But so I think there have been a couple of things that have helped, if not become more predictive, but help player development staffs put players in the best position to succeed. And that is really all they can do. You know, they can't go out and play the game. And there's so many variables that come into players' injuries and recognizing breaking pitches, you know, command. You can only do so much. But the combination of data, and so that there's so much more data, and the strength and conditioning and the psychological side of things. And I think starting on the scouting side, you know, the homework that's done by scouts to get a sense of the makeup of a player helps. Again, not 100%, but helps. Being able to individuate strength and conditioning programs, so you're not just taking players and saying you all do the same thing, you know, based on their, now you can do it based on their position, based on their body type, based on where their strengths and weaknesses lie. I think all that helps. And then, you know, the teams that do the best are the ones who use the huge uptick in data analysis combined with regular old school, quote unquote, old school evaluation and scouting and development, you know, reps in the cage and things like that, are the ones that do it right. And I think that is what has helped what seems to be an uptick of young players getting to the big leagues. I think, again, this is completely anecdotal. It feels like they're getting to the big leagues faster. Not all of them. You know, there are the Kyle Lewis's and the Jake Fraley's who, you know, have injuries and things like that, or guys who just took a little longer to figure it out. But you're seeing a lot of younger guys get to the big leagues, I think, faster because the learning curve has been shortened because of some of those things that I mentioned.
You know, speaking of that learning curve and injuries, this 2020 season could turn into a bit of a situation where it's not an injury, but every minor leaguer out there might end up having to forcibly take off 17 months of live ball because there might not be a minor league season. And that's purely speculative. From your point of view, how much would a lost season, an entirely lost season for minor leaguers impact their player development? And is that something that you think could have long-term ramifications on, you know, the quality of big league ball? Or share your thoughts there.
I think the only thing that keeps it from having a long-term impact is that everyone is in exactly the same place, right? So it's not one player blew out his knee or needs Tommy John surgery and he's got to press pause on everything. Everybody is doing that. Now, I think all teams are trying to do whatever they can to help players maintain strength and conditioning. This is, you know, without any reps, you know, so I think it's the lack of going out and playing obviously is going to have an impact, but everyone is in exactly the same boat and everyone is going to disembark from the boat at the same time. There are going to be some players who are more ready for it because they got after it as best as they could. Maybe it was because they had a better setup in their house. Stroke of luck. Maybe, you know, the mental toughness of some is better than others. So there are guys who just, listen, I'm going to do whatever I can to get myself better every day with what I'm given, while other guys might be sitting on their couch playing, you know, PlayStation too much. We'll have to wait and see. But because everybody had to press pause for this prolonged period of time, I think everyone's going to come back more or less the same. Does that mean that if you know, whenever baseball returns, is the product going to be not as sharp at first? Probably. But, you know, I think everyone is going to be on the same curve. So I don't know that it's going to make that much of a difference in terms of getting guys back and things like that. I think the guys that it's really going to hurt who are already in the pro game are maybe, you know, let's say you had a guy who had Tommy John surgery and he was just getting back on, you know, onto a mound and he was sort of on that path to pitching opening day or pitching early May and hasn't been able to pitch. Now he's been able to continue strengthening. Maybe that guy slowed up a little bit, but again, because everyone is in the same boat, I don't know that it's going to make that much of a difference.
Sure.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Okay, well, let's pop into a little bit of the MLB draft because that's been a hot topic on Twitter, and you know, it potentially being shortened to 5 rounds, maybe 10. We've seen some reports of there being maybe 10 rounds. You do a ton of research and homework on this thing every year. Where do you stand on it being shortened to, you know, maybe 5 rounds?
That's making my life a lot easier. You know, I don't have to. We do if it's shortened to 5 rounds, it's a lot easier. And listen, you know, we do live pick by pick through round 10 every year. And for those who tune into day two, that is, people always think, oh, day one, man, you're on the air for so long. It's like, that's the easy part. Those are the players where, like, we really, really know. There's a handful that we have to scramble. But day two of the draft, very quickly we get to the point where we, like, players get drafted and we don't know, and we put out a call, and our friends in the scouting industry are amazing to us and send us information. So if you watch day two, we'll readily admit, you know, we don't know that player, but we're going to get information on him. So, you know, if we do 5 rounds of the draft and we're going to expand our list to top 200, we're not going to see 200 players get drafted. You know, that's 200 players is like into the top of the seventh round. Not that everyone from the top 200 gets drafted, because we do that based on talent. We don't talk about signability, things like that. But, you know, it is interesting. We've been sort of talking. I keep teasing Jim Callis, who keeps saying, like, well, if we want, because especially because the draft, we don't know when it's going to be yet, but it's not going to be when it normally is scheduled. You know, I'm guessing end of June, maybe beginning of July. We have some extra time. We could expand our list to 300. But if there's only five rounds of the draft, there's really no point in doing that whatsoever, because we're not going to get anywhere close to that many players drafted. It just changes who's going to get drafted and who we have to really try to focus on.
MLB, you guys just released a new re-ranked top 150 prospects for 2020. And there's a lot of people that believe this is one of the deeper classes in the last 10 years. How do you personally think it stacks up to some of the better ones, like 2015 or 2000, maybe 2013? What are your thoughts on the crop as a whole?
So I will begin by saying that my institutional memory is terrible. that's why I started off by saying how old I am. So, yes, I think it's deep. I'm interested why you picked 2013 as a strong class, because I'm looking through here. And, you know, it's easy to look through.
I believe 2015 was what he meant.
Retrospective glasses. 2015 was a very good class. You know what? And I think what makes this class really interesting, especially given how we're going to be dealing with kind of new parameters, is that it's a very college-heavy up top. You know, you look at our top 150, top six are all college guys. Nine out of the top 10 are college guys. I think this is a year, because of the fewer rounds, where having track record, because you didn't get to go out and see guys this spring, is going to be important. So I think you're going to see even more than normal college guys sort of slinking up, while the high school guys, especially the high school pitchers, move down, even if based on talent, it should be a little different. And that happens every year. I think you're going to see more of that this year. And it is a strong class, with the exception of middle infielders. You mentioned that 2015 draft, and that was what Dansby Swanson, Alex Bregman, Brendan Rodgers right off the top. Mm-hmm. That was a really good class for shortstops. It's really bad this year, really, really thin in terms of middle infielders, especially guys who you think have a chance to play shortstop every day at the big league level.
So you said it's college heavy. College pitching heavy? Is it across the board? It's strong pitchers. It's strong position players. Across the board for college.
So I would say that it is across the board. I mean, at the very top, you know, it's four of the top six are hitters, college hitters. So, but overall, it's a really strong college pitching class, especially if you compare to like last year. I think I saw that we had 10 college pitchers in our top 50 last year, and there are 18 this year. And even if you just sort of put them side by side, some of the guys who are at the bottom of that 18 of the top 50 or even beyond, if you put them in last year's class, would be way up higher on draft boards. So it's both. There is a drop off in college bats after the top group. And that's where the college aren't, but there's a nice chunk of like end of first round, comp round, second round college arms who, you know, that's where the track record will come into play, where I think some of those probably sneak into the back end of the first round. Normally they would do that based on their performance over the course of the year. But if a guy pitched for Team USA or on the Cape last summer, those guys are going to probably move up because you have slightly more certainty than some of the high school arms.
Do you think that there's going to be an incentive for teams also to lean even more heavily towards those college guys in this draft, given the importance with maybe 5, maybe 10 BICs of signability and of, you know, having what limited draft pool access you have be fully available to you, especially since there's not that back end where you can then spread, you know, spread the pool around? Or do you think that it's going to kind of play out on a case-by-case basis?
Right. So there are a couple things at play. There's a big difference between it being a 5-round draft and a 10-round draft. If it's a 10-round draft, in a lot of ways, it's like they've always done. They'll have their full draft pool to play with. So you could go back to there being more flexibility. Obviously, you won't have the run at guys in the 11th round, high school guys, you know, that became popular. So that wouldn't happen. The other thing is, one thing that we have no way of knowing is, given what's been going on from a financial standpoint with baseball, even if it's a full 10 rounds, could owners tell their baseball people, you know what, I know you have the full bonus pool, but you can only spend 50% of that because, you know, we've not brought in any revenue. Could that happen? I think there's a distinct possibility that could happen. We won't know, you know, until guys are signed and we see how the draft rolls out. If the draft is only 5 rounds, then even more so, I think some of those college guys will go. The college seniors, you know, they'll have a choice like they did in the past, but you know, now anything past the 5th or 10th round is going to be set at a 20K limit.
Yeah.
Now, some of those college seniors would have been asked to sign for $10,000. You know, what was happening is the good college seniors were understanding that they, you know, they'd get offered $10,000 to sign in the 6th round. They'd say no because they'd get $20,000 in the 12th round.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's still well under the $100,000 or whatever that was the pick value for anything beyond the 10th round. So some of those guys will be fine. Some of the college performer types, you know, who might have gone and been given, even if they signed for under slot, but would get 100K in the 3rd round. I'm arbitrarily picking random numbers.
Sure.
Happen. So I think it gets it's going to push some high school guys to college. Today, I learned that Kyle Teal, who's a high school catcher from New Jersey, sent a letter removing himself from the draft. Strong commitment to University of Virginia. Hmm. Not like a top tier player. He just missed our top 150.
Mm-hmm.
So would he be the kind of guy that someone may have decided that they really liked and took in the 3rd round and gave him 2nd round money? And would that have done it? Maybe. But though, you know, he was on the fence, so he just removed himself. I think there are going to be a bunch of other guys who will just roll the dice and see how it plays out. But there's going to be fewer opportunities, especially in a 5-round draft, for teams to overpay to sign a high school kid away from college.
You know, I hadn't given any thought to the idea that organizations could still tell their front offices, hey, you may have $9 million to spend here, but we're only going to allow you to spend, you know, 2 or 3 of it. So, you know, maybe you see some of those college seniors like you were talking about sneak into the first or second, like maybe a Landon Knack or a Brian Van Bell sneaks into, you know, the 1st, 2nd, or 3rd round just because, hey, we know we can get you for 50 grand.
Right. I mean, it becomes what the college seniors were during the normal 10-round draft. So I think there is the distinct possibility. And Knack is a fascinating guy just because, like, he seems really, really good, but he's 23 and not had a straight path. And, like, what do you, how do you do that? And you didn't have that much time to evaluate him this spring. So he's a really, really kind of interesting guy.
Well, let's talk a little bit further down into the draft, and specifically some of the players that you are projecting going in the 1st round. Most people that are interested in the draft know the top 5. It seems like there is a clear drop-off, or maybe a clear drop-off isn't the best way of saying it, but it seems like the top 5 are going to go in some order to the top 5 teams. Maybe outside of those top 5, is there a guy that really you're particularly high on, kind of one of those who's your guy type situations in the draft?
Sure. You know, in the top 5 guys, you know, Spencer Torkelson, Austin Martin, Ace Lacy, Emerson Hancock, Nick Gonzalez, you know, Garrett Mitchell, who's the 6th of the 6 college guys, from a tools standpoint is just as good as anybody else on the list. I mean, he has more the best all-around tool package in the entire draft. He also is a type 1 diabetic, which is the one question mark that teams feel that they will need to have answered. But he's really, 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 really good. So there isn't a drop-off talent-wise. There's just trying to get a sense of what to do with that. I think if I were going to pick a guy that I really like a little bit further down, because Zach Veen is now the top high school guy, he's really good, I think I would probably pick Robert Hassel, who's number 16 on our list. And again, going back to the fact that I saw him a bunch in the PDP league over the summer, and he was the best hitter in the PDP league. I know some scouts who think he is the best pure high school bat. You know, Austin Hendrick has more raw power, and, you know, maybe I should pick Austin Hendrick because he's from my hometown here in Pittsburgh, but Hassel can really hit. He's pretty athletic. He throws 92, 93 off the mound. But no, you know, no one wants him to pitch. He's a right field type. He could probably play center because, you know, he is pretty, you know, fairly athletic. I just think that he is a guy who is kind of like a slightly more athletic Riley Green, you know, who the Tigers took last year. And to be fair to Riley Green, he, you know, that was the question mark about Riley Green. And then he showed up last spring and was much more athletic, got his body in better shape. Which is why he ended up being a top 10 pick. Robert Hassel, in a lot of ways, was already thought of as Riley Green was thought of as the draft approached last year. So, you know, if you told me that Robert Hassel ends up sneaking up into the top 10, I could believe it. And I think he's really going to hit.
We have someone on our staff that is the biggest Robert Hassel fan, so she'll be thrilled to hear that.
Yes, Kate Bruiser, staff managing editor, is Kate, cheering for quarantine.
She loves her some Robert Hassel. Going back on Zach Veen, I was speaking to a scout a couple days ago, and you know, everyone keeps throwing around the Cody Bellinger, the Christian Yelich comps, and you know that's easy to do. They're sexy names. He threw out a Sean Green comp, which I thought was fascinating. He said, the way that this kid is built, he's a grinder. He goes about his business, and he's going to do everything the right way. And I thought that was, it came out of left field, but I love it. I think that's a fun one for Zach Veen.
Yeah, and I'm guessing this was a scout who's been at it for a little while. You can usually gauge the age of a scout.
Oh, yeah.
Back they go. It was like I was talking about another. I'll get to Zach Veen in a second. But there's a player on our list, Enrique Bradfield Jr., who's probably the fastest guy in the draft. But there's questions about his physicality. And the scout I was talking to said that he heard some of the older scouts slap a Mickey Rivers comp. I'm like, wow.
Oh, geez.
70s. And I'm like, I love that. Now, you know, a lot of young fans today would be like, Mickey Rivers, what? Juan Pierre is another one, you know, who's not quite as old school. But so, yeah, I've heard those comps about Zach Veen. He took a huge step forward in terms of the power. He's one of the guys that the short amount of time that he was seen this summer helped. Being in Florida, you know, certainly helped because you can go see him if you're in spring training or on your way to University of Florida or whatever it is. So I think that he took a nice step forward over the summer that put him right in sort of first round territory, and then up to being the top high school guy because of everything coming together. He's still projectable, 6'4". The Sean Green comp I like. I could see it. I've heard Kyle Tucker, you know, not in terms of how he goes about it, but just in terms of the overall tool package. It depends on who you talk to.
Well, if you're listening, head on over to MLBpipeline.com because you're not going to find a more comprehensive scouting report on a lot of these players. You got all five tools on a 20 to 80 scale. You got write-ups on the top 150. MLB Pipeline and all the work that Jim and Jonathan are doing on a daily basis is a great resource For those of you who are interested in the draft coming up this July, we would assume it could be in August. But I'll leave you with one final question here, Jonathan. The sixth pick, a lot of people kind of think that's where the draft will start because, like I had mentioned, the top five may go as expected. If you're Jerry DePoto and you've got Zach Veen, like you had mentioned, Garrett Mitchell, maybe Reed Detmers. If you've got the sixth pick, who are you selecting, John?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is if I'm Jerry DePoto, I let Scott Hunter and Tommy Allison make the pick. But that's just me.
how politically correct.
And by the way, I think that's, you know, how they do it. That said, I mean, so there are a couple things at play. You know, I think the one thing, you know, we've been talking about Zach Veen, but the Mariners have not taken a high school player in the first round since Alex Jackson. That doesn't mean that you wouldn't do it again. I think he kind of fits in that ballpark. I don't know what their reports on Garrett Mitchell are. He kind of fits the college bat mold. You know, I know that the Mariners, you know, the last 2 years, they've done really well, not picking as high, but taking Logan Gilbert, who I love, and George Kirby, who throws more strikes than any human being on the planet. So I think they could go for one of those college arms. You know, Max Meyer really intrigues me stuff-wise. I know he's not that big, but I kind of like him. So you're sort of saying that the draft starts there is true. I guess the last 2 years, like, things have kind of gone according to the way people thought they would. But it wouldn't shock me if, say, let's say the Blue Jays decide to take Zach Veen at five. Then someone's going to fall to the Mariners, sort of how they got Kyle Lewis that year when they didn't think that was going to happen. So I think they'd be happy to take any of the top five college guys, and then they'll have to decide what they want to do. So I'm kind of not answering your direct question. If it were me personally, I probably would take Zach Veen. But, man, Garrett Mitchell has done it. He's gotten better. The questions about him, you know, about his swing in high school have all been answered. He's really, really good. So as long as you're comfortable with him handling his diabetes, which he's been doing since he was 11 years old, that might be the direction I would go in.
Well, John, do you have John Troopin? Do you have any final thoughts? Any last questions?
I think that you really sort of summed up. You know, this is fairly unprecedented, but it's going to be exciting in the way that things that are brand new always are particularly exciting. Thank you so much, Jonathan, for taking the time to chat with us. We really appreciate you sharing your expertise and your perspective on this.
My pleasure, guys, and hopefully next time we can actually talk about baseball. Let's go.
That is the hope. All right. Well,
that's the hope.
All right. Well, thank you all for listening. We will be back next week with another episode of They Might Be Mariners. Until then, stay safe, be well. I take my chances on the road.